Good morning, everyone. Welcome. This is Jess from Critical Resistance. I'm one of the co-directors of the organization. And I'm going to get us going this morning so that we can have a full hour with our incredible panelists who have volunteered to be part of this conversation and engage with us all about the work that they've done using visual art as a practice for communicating PIC abolition and also working towards PIC abolition in their work as organizers and cultural workers. And what I think is really exciting about the group that we have here today is that many of them have been fellow travelers inside, alongside CR since the founding, and that's really special. So we have people who, we have a co-founder, we have people who have contributed to the conferences over the years as CR was shaping and forming itself, and also someone who has been an ally doing cultural work with us in coalitions as we've been building campaigns and projects and being out in the world. So this is a donor call for Critical Resistance, and there's something that we offer quarterly to build up shared understanding of the vision and mission that we are working towards for prison industrial complex abolition, and to engage with you all as supporters, because we know that every level of participation in CR is essential for us thriving. We have transitioned to be 65% grassroots donor funded. And so every role, whether you contribute time as a volunteer member, support us when we are in doing an event or something out in the world, making propaganda, spreading our messaging, getting people organizing with us, or are a donor, which enables us to have the resources to make these campaigns and projects go, is all part of our movement building. So thank you for joining us today and for keeping us going now every day of the year. So the topic for today's donor call is art and abolition. And since the founding of Critical Resistance, we've modeled that cultural practice and art, visual art, poetry, performance, drama, are critical components of the fight for imagining, enacting a world without the prison industrial complex. And the power of reclaiming culture taken from communities through centuries of colonization, genocide, social and economic repression, and the practices of creating are themselves acts of resistance, and even more powerful when applied specifically towards the vision of PIC abolition. And so today we're going to be exploring the ways that art and abolition intertwine, how the cultural workers and artists who are here on this call have been helping us envision the world that we want to do and building things to move us towards getting there. So without further ado, I'm going to ask our panelists, our featured speakers, to introduce themselves with a bit about who you are, what you're working on now, and specifically what your art project or practice that you're engaging with you see as connected to abolition and abolitionist vision. So just a small starter question, but to get us going and so we know who's amongst us today. So Melanie, could you start us? What are you working on now, a little bit about yourself, and how your art projects or praxis engage with abolition?
Sure. So I am a political graphic artist. I'm co-founder of a project called Digni Better Belde. We're a collaboration, a collaborative space, really, that's intended to bring people together and really push back against the idea of the individual and the individual artist in particular, but really see collective work as the kind of work we want to engage in. And let's see, there's a couple things I'm working on. One, I'm trying to finish up a mural for a community gallery called Galería de la Raza in the Mission District of San Francisco. The exhibit is called FPP, For the People, and it's really a response to the outcome of Alex Nieto being killed and really not seeing anything happen to the police officers that shot him over 50 times. So I really like the idea of this project because it really came out of a conversation about trying to get beyond looking for justice from the very system that are replicating these harms and killing our people, and really was inspired, I think, by Audre Lorde's essay, The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House. And so that's the challenge that's been kind of put forth in the conversation, and even being able to create space in this exhibit for the Nietos, Alex's parents, to create an altar for them, because I think they were so involved in the trial and they were like really selective. Like there's a photo on his graduation day where he has a bottle of alcohol in his hand, but you know, they were at a celebration. He was, you know, and they talked about like, they love that photo. He looks so happy. I mean, when I saw it, I started crying because that real emotional impact of knowing like this person is gone and there's nothing that's ever going to be able to change that. And that they couldn't use that photo, you know, in the trial because he has a bottle of alcohol, and they felt like, you know, they would use the photo against him because we see it time and time again. So I think, while it's an exhibit, this is a community gallery that was, you know, basically an alternative to white wall galleries in the 70s. It was community run and it was intended for the Raza community in the Mission when it was founded in the 1970s. So I think a lot of what's happening in the conversations and just being in a space with a lot of people that are thinking and talking about this issue has been really great, because a lot of conversations happen and people are having conversations about other things that are happening, like the hunger strike and being really worried about the strikers, because it's what, day 16, I think, today now, because all of it is tied together. And there's all these efforts where people are trying to figure out, like, what are we going to do to have justice, and how do we hold each other, and how do we be well? And that's the piece that I'm working on is addressing that issue. And I think what I hope it will do is just continue to stimulate the community building and the conversation about what those visions are. And I think really any projects, because there's other projects that I'm working on as well, like that's the best thing that can come out of it, is like a sense of building more community, having a different way to build relationship through creating, right? Like I've been reflecting a lot about how so much of what we're responding to is this force that's really destructive, and what does it mean to create collectively to really push back against those forces of destruction. So that's just one thing I'm working on. I'm going to work on it after this call to the gallery. And folks are welcome, if they're in the Bay Area, to come to the opening tomorrow. It's at 2 o'clock to daytime reception.
What a great timing for this call, then. Thanks so much for the invitation and announcement. And so in between sleeping, we've got the artist on the call. Much appreciated. Let's pass it to, thank you, Melanie. Let's pass it to Kai. So, Kai, can you introduce yourself and what you're working on now and anything you'd like to share about your art projects or practice as a political engagement with abolition or abolitionist vision?
Those are big questions. Hi, everybody. First of all, I really appreciate a conversation that's focused on visual art and that's focused on visual art in relationship to radical questions of structural change. So, you know, I often, I don't get to participate in or see these conversations happen too often. So I'm really, you know, happy to be here. I am currently working, I've been developing a new, to me new, nothing's new under the sun, but I've been trying to create a genre or an approach to art that is both, that has both an organizing component and also helps to shift our imaginations. And I call this concept visual opera. And I'm currently working on my second visual opera. The first one was called, the one that most people are familiar with, was called Echo Hybridity, Love Song for Nola. And it looked at 10 years post-Katrina, what does, looks at disaster capitalism 10 years post-Katrina, in particular its impact on queer black women and gender nonconforming people in New Orleans. And so this was a large-scale roving performance and installation, series of installations. There were 7 installations, and there was an ongoing performance from 9 a.m. till 2 a.m. that looked at the different components, like I said, of disaster capitalism, from housing to the PIC to environment and a range of different things. So that was in August. And since that point, I've been just trying to, you know, come back from that. There was, I worked with 25 black feminists. We started from a point of political education. So we started by engaging, actually, a chief resource was Catherine McKittrick and Clyde Wood's book, Black Geography. But we also have a pretty extensive reading list bibliography, which I call an unbibliography. It's on the website. It includes visual art, it includes music, a range of different ways that we take in information as part of, was part of how we started our work together, our collaboration together. Where was I with that? We started with that conversation, and then we went into teams to make this, and we only had like 9 months. We went into teams to make this large-scale project, and it got a lot of support from folks around the country, and it showed that people were really interested in engaging these questions from, like I said, an imaginative place as opposed to only from a didactic place. At this point, I'm working on the next piece. It's early, so it's like in that period where, you know, it can change any moment. But I'm focusing on the radio opera from Luigi Dalla Piccola called The Prisoner. And Woman on the Edge of Time by Piercy. And I'm looking at these two, I'm adapting these two texts, these two works to actually focus on madness and structural oppression in relation, again, to black women and gender nonconforming people in terms of the PIC. So I am having a hard time really describing it right now because it's in such a very, just a really genesis period. But I'm really looking at confinement and resistance and the ways that we resist confinement even while being confined. So what are methods for resistance? And looking at madness as one of the tools we use to both, you know, escape and also shift our realities. So that's kind of what I'm looking at right now. I'm going to stop.
Okay, that sounds really fascinating, and I have all sorts of extra questions now popping up.
Good.
So material for now. Let's pass it to Ashley. Ashley Hunt, do you want to talk about what you're working on and abolitionist vision through your art?
Sure. Thanks so much. Thanks for including me today, and thanks, Melanie and Kai, for your introductions. It's so great to hear what you're both working on right now. I've been making work around prisons as a subject matter, a set of histories, as a kind of institution, and have for quite a while, and have been doing that. Have always tried to do that with as an artist who has a certain footing in the art world, and then also always tries to incorporate, think about how the work is done, either set within organizing, or like directly, or thinking about how it can contribute to organizing, or offer tools to organizing. I've done a variety of projects that have worked to kind of like describe what we mean when we talk about the prison industrial complex, other than the prison itself. And then also the work that I've been focusing on more recently is thinking about how prisons are concealed within the larger landscapes that that we live within. Oftentimes concealed out of sight in ways that that I think have a great deal to do with how the prison industrial complex is able to survive and be a thing. The I guess the kind of some of the general ways that I think about art and the ways in which it relates to organizing is that my understanding of art has to do with the fact that art, one of the things that art does at its core is that it organizes. And the kind of obvious historical sense of that is that it organizes our perception visually. But I've also always been very interested in how it organizes bodies, how it organizes people, how it can organize communities. And so I think one of the things that I've always tried to include in some of the like more documentary works that I've done have been making sure that there's always a representation of people actively opposing the system, or that alongside some kind of analysis of the system, or whatever it is I've been doing, or a description of a campaign or something, that there's always a way of seeing that it's possible to move against this, and that people are in fact doing that. and that's meant a few different kinds of things. I think one of the things that I've also focused on is that I think relates to this is just, and I think both Kai and Melanie point to this as well, is that if the prison industrial complex is not just about prisons, but is about things that root deeply into all kind of sectors of life and institutions and economies around us, then the talking about prisons alone is not the only thing that art can address. So one of the so I've also been engaged over the years in just doing community-based projects that themselves have a kind of organizing component that aren't always sometimes are political organizing, but other times are just thinking about how a community is organized. That communities are always organized in some kind of way, and doing work that facilitates that. And one of the projects that I just opened up a second installment of that with is a project called the School for the Movement of the Technicolor People, where which is a dance school. it's an exhibition that functions as a dance school that teaches a curriculum that comes out of this dance company that was founded by Taisha Padgett in Los Angeles, and is organized around questions of black dance and what is some idea of what is a black dance curriculum, and thinking about how a queer black dance curriculum is a political question rather than only a aesthetic question or something like that. And the exhibition has been conceived as a I've contributed mostly photographs and video works for this, but we've conceived of the exhibition as a way to provide a kind of infrastructure for that school, and then it offers it free dance classes to the public that are formed out of this company that's a queer black and ally company that Taisha was organized. The other project I've been working on, what's that?
Oh, I thought you were pausing. I was thanking you.
Okay. I'll just reference really quickly the other main project that is finally coming to a realization in the world is a project called Degrees of Visibility, where I found my own primary background is as a photographer and filmmaker, and I found myself starting to work on my finding myself becoming really interested photographically in the ways in which prisons are literally concealed within the landscapes around us, and how that's actually a technique of how the prison operates. And like I said before, how that actually facilitates the growth of the prison industrial complex. I can say more about that if people are more interested in talking about that. But I guess the last thing I'll just say quickly is around this question of art and abolition. I think that one of the questions that I've we've asked in working with CR over the years about what abolition means in a practical sense is thinking about is asking the question, in any given circumstance, how does what we're doing right now sort of deplete the resources of the prison industrial complex, or make it less useful, force it to become more useless, or does what we're doing, even if it seems to be reforming something, does it actually strengthen the system in some kind of way? And I think we can ask the same question of the artworks that we produce. We can ask what this contributes, because of course there are many histories of art and images that that actually are a part of that system itself. So
thank you, Ashley.
I'll leave it there.
Yeah, that's a great, I feel like that's actually the perfect place to close on with that comment. So for people who've just joined us, we've got on the line with us Kaila Mumba-Barrow, who is working on visual operas for imagining and enacting resistance to the prison industrial complex and other modes of disaster capitalism. Melanie Cervantes of Dignidad Rebelde, a political printmaker, and Ashley Hunt, a visual artist, primarily works in photo and video, though has also done other things such as community-based projects and curriculum. And so thinking about, Kai, what you said about trying to engage people from a place, from an imaginative place rather than a didactic one. And Ashley, what you just left us with asking of our art, how does this art piece or our work as artists deplete the PIC or force it to become more useless? I wonder if we could, I'd like us to talk about visual politics, which I think are different distinctly than aesthetics. One of you said how these are political choices, not just, you know, stylistic ones. So CR has visual politics of not featuring bars unless they're being broken, handcuffs unless they're being opened, of imprisoned people and people on the street resisting rather than being subject to or at the brunt of the violence of the prison industrial complex. And so some of you were part of setting us in this direction in the planning for Critical Resistance South, and some of you I know this is part of your politics that you have brought with you, and maybe you met CR along the way. And so I'm actually going to ask Melanie to respond to this question first. Can you speak a bit about how this visual politics resonates with you, and to use Ashley's language, how does this mode of representing things and of creating deplete the power of the prison industrial complex?
Yeah, I think the question's great because, you know, it's not one, you know, that we've used, but I think it's incredibly useful. I think the question of representation, like that's something that I deal with all the time. So we collaborate with a lot of folks, and I think there's an inclination to reproduce that imagery of confinement, surveillance. And there have been projects that I've had to sever ties with because I'm like, I don't do that. Like, it's not helpful. I think another thing that we tend not to do in our practice is reproduce kind of the agents of oppression. You know, like we tend to focus, I think, somewhat like what you were saying, Ashley, of the agents of change, the people that are actually doing, you know, actively doing things to chip away at the PIC. And that can be everything from, you know, like actually doing kind of protests at sites of detention centers or prisons, but it can also be like, you know, the community garden or the art projects that bring people together, like the alternatives or the routes that take us away from relying on the PIC, because we reproduce those systems, right, and how we sometimes solve conflict, I think, is a good example. So creating works that elevate those practices and elevate our sense of agency around those practices, like that, I feel like is more useful, because reproducing that same imagery doesn't get us anywhere except where we already are. It's incredibly disempowering, and I think one of the challenges is that many people feel like that really addressing the PIC is like an impossibility. Like when I talk to people about it, even after the conversation that happened in Los Angeles with Angela Davis and Fred Martin, like I went out with my family to have dinner, and it was like my sister-in-law and my parents, so we're all having conversations about it, and there's, I think, this sense of it's inevitable and impossible, and to invite people into a process to create and to think about, just because it's never been done before, it doesn't mean it's impossible, and how do we reflect on what we're already doing, or like what does work that takes us away from that. You know, I think of, like examples of like how we deal with conflicts where we're not calling the police. How do we deal with health issues where we're not, you know, inadvertently bringing in the police? Those images, because, you know, a lot of what we do is visual imagery, I think that serves us more because we don't see it. And I think it's purposeful that we keep seeing people, you know, handcuffed behind bars. Like, if we can't imagine the future that we're working toward, like, we're never going to get there. If we can't have that in our mind's eye, in our, you know, and really drive that from our heart, it's going to be impossible to walk that path toward it. So for me, as someone who makes images, and works with people to kind of conjure what those images will be, it's really important that we can imagine it, because that's the powerful place we can start, like, working toward those visions.
Wow, thanks so much, Melanie. I think that's, yeah, I'm just hearing so much there about helping us imagine so we can actually be on the path to carrying it out. And so as those visual tools are part of our organizing, which is, you know, if we think about CR's definition of abolition as both a long-term vision and a strategy, it's that way that we're imagining what we're doing as we're building together. Ashley, can you talk a bit about how and why these came to be the politics of critical resistance? And Kai, please do hop in, because you were in CR and possibly even on staff at the time leading up to the CR South Conference. So why did CR or people who are organizing towards this conference shift towards, to use Melanie's language, works that elevate our sense of agency rather than reproducing the tools of the master forces of repression?
And then I love that way of phrasing it, and I also, one thought I just had, an additional question that from what Melanie was saying around, you know, applying the, thinking about how if one abolitionist strategy in daily life is to figure out how to not call the cops in a given situation, and how else to deal with things, I think it's also could be interesting to think of asking that of an artwork, right? How can an artwork not call the cops? What would that mean to ask that? But as far as I know, I can really just speak from my own kind of memory of conversations and so forth. I think some of the early graphics of graphic representations for CR included, well, the two main iconic things I can remember are a coil of razor wire that was beneath the main critical resistance logo, and then there was but then there was also this eye, and it's from a painting that I can't remember whose painting that in was. I don't
Rupert
know.
Rupert Garcia, I think.
Rupert Garcia, yeah, the eye.
Yeah.
The
and I wasn't there to be.
Eye.
And I would say that in that eye, that there was not just the sense of a kind of counter-surveillance or we're looking back, you know, in a way that rather than just being looked at, that of course itself does begin to talk about agency within the system rather than only being subjected to it. I think there was also something in the eye that spoke to vision and needing vision and one of the early slogans, as I remember, of critical resistance was always beyond the prison industrial complex. So it was never there was always that question of beyond. And but the thing that came up in around CR South was a questioning of things like just having that razor wire sitting there, and what that did. And I think this is also a time in which I remember people starting to talk more directly about abolition as more a part of every conversation. I think people were starting to go back to looking at the like the American Friends Service book instead of prisons from I think the early 70s, and starting to, which kind of, I think, laid the roots or foundation for what became the abolitionist publication from CR and other things. And there was a reprinting of that book, right?
It's available on the CR website.
Yeah. But so in the questions around the kind of propaganda and imagery for the conference, there was just this sense consensus of like we're really sick of looking at these devices of the prison industrial complex in ways that just kind of treat them as a given, that they're just there and they're going to be there like that, you know, and that's how they work and that's it, you know. I think as much as that was accompanied by a kind of political analysis of visual work, I think people were just sick of it too. I better just remember the fatigue around that. And so there was a question of like, well, what else do we represent? If we're trying to think beyond, if we're trying to think life without the prison industrial complex, then what does that look like? And so I think balancing that with at the same time wanting to have some kind of visual anchor that says, okay, but we're still talking about the prison industrial complex. The main kind of graphic that was developed for the conference was this kind of empty road that looks like that kind of vanishes in this kind of perspective over a hill or something, and it looks like a road of possibility, a road where someone can go, and floating kind of in the air above the road was this empty pair of handcuffs that looked like someone had kind of like someone had tore them off and or gotten out of them and kind of like tossed them out the back window of the car, and the car has now vanished. The car is already moving ahead from there. So that's, I mean, I think that that kind of captures that historical piece for me. But I don't know, Kai, if you have, I imagine you have other memories and so forth of that.
Yeah, I mean, I really remember, this is really funny, because I'm looking at my work. I'm working as we speak, by the way, because, you know, got some deadlines. But that said, I'm looking at my work as we speak, and people often talk about how, you know, you can see, like, lots of eyes or the eye symbol in my work, and I'm like, that probably came from Critical Resistance. Where did that come from? You know, and I remember after the 98 conference, or, you know, before the 98 conference, planning for the conference, a lot of folks had, a lot of people that I was talking to had concerns and, you know, wanted to really talk about the eye. The eye was really problematic for a lot of folks. And people wanted far more representational kind of imagery. And I remember thinking, nah, I like this eye. There's something provocative about the eye. I think that's one thing that really set the tone for CR's visual politics, to step away from, you know, tropes, and to actually look at how can we be exploratory and experimental in this idea of abolition, like presenting this idea of abolition. So I was, I think, one of the earliest symbols and images that we had that started to really define our politics. I think Shana Agate, I want to give Shana Agate a big shout out, because I know Shana was engaged a lot, and I think a lot of several of us were in trying to think through the questions of visual politic. And yeah, actually, I remember just being frustrated, like, we don't want to see doves and chains and bars, and, you know, and even if they're broken, we kind of want to try to step away from that. So just even today, like, still, how do you visualize abolition, right? And so I think, you know, when you're talking about even the, you know, idea, the very idea of abolition is an illustration of radical imagination, right? Just to even consider abolition, we're engaging in a place of radical imagination, right? So then how do we, and therefore it's a transgressive act, right? So then how do we take that transgression and then help facilitate more transgression, more imagination, more provocativeness in terms of our work? And is there, and what are the politics behind it? So for me, I think that, you know, I've been trying to do work that's dialogic, so that it invites participation through interaction, through political education. There's dialogue about it. It's oppositional. It's big. My work is big and really brightly colored, and I like to put it in your face so that it's bold, and I think oppositional also means that it embraces contradictions, right? So, you know, what does it mean for me as a painter to use, like, toxic chemicals to make this work? So I started trying to work with more, you know, dyes, like natural dyes, like cheese and coffee stains and that sort of work. Tried to use a lot more recycled materials, found objects. And also I think that the work should, you know, our work as abolitionists should be erotic. I think it should be passionate. I think it should be visceral. And then from that, we begin to talk about, you know, what is it that we're trying to envision. And I think that I'm personally becoming more and more, maybe anti-representational. I'm the, like the anti-representational person. I'm wanting to get away from representational politics and really look more at abstraction. So that you have to do a level of, like I said, it's dialogic. You have to do some level of engagement, or you just walk by it, right? But I'm trying to ask you to go into a space of abstraction and bring with that, bring into that what you see and what you think, so that we can continue to have a dialogue. Like, it has to be ongoing. The work has to produce an ongoing desire to engage, you know, whether that means you want to touch it, whether it means you want to smell it, whether it means it moves you in a particular way, whether you don't understand it, whether you think it's ugly, whatever it is, it has to generate some form of action. And I think in that sense, then it opens up the door for us to talk about abolition and strategies that are counter-normative, you know?
Wow, okay, that's awesome.
I said a lot. I know, I just went all over the place with that one. But I think those are the things that critical resistance has actually helped me think about it. And I didn't realize that till this talk, so thanks, CR.
Well, thank you for, you know, bringing us to where we are almost 20 years after you first got involved and helped make us an organization.
For God.
So I had some more questions up my sleeves about galleries versus street art and mural spaces, and some specific questions about I mean, maybe Kai just answered it about art generating some form of action and opening up the door for us to talk about abolition. But I'm also wondering if there are any questions from people who have called in or donors and supporters. I know there's some artists on the line also. Is there anyone who wants to pose a question for any of our speakers? Don't be shy.
Hi, this is Anna. I do have, I'm interested in the gallery versus in the streets question, but I'm also interested in how you work with community. So I think Ashley referenced, I think you said that the eye was problematic for folks who wanted a more representative approach. So how do you help shift people in a way that respects communities?
Okay, I wanna talk about something currently that I'm in conversation with people around, specifically around the idea of art that responds to police terror or murder, right? And so I've been in conversation with people who are doing this kind of national quilt that it's an evolving project, but quilt that goes from community to community and that calls attention to people within that community who were killed by police. And it's a really, and I think Melanie, you're referring to some of that too. It's a really interesting process because you have to be very careful. Family members want their people to be represented in their best light, so to speak, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what you were talking about, Melanie, with the images that aren't allowed in court, or how do we show our people? And I think there's lots of contradictions that we have, as artists have to deal with. I've worked with folks on murals in community, and people did not, you know, and a process would be that you involve your community in the process, right? You let, you know, you sit in meetings and you talk about design,
And people have, you know, been, you know, I don't want that image of my loved one because they don't look like that. They're not that dark skinned. They're, you know, so these kind of ideas of representation that are very much rooted in white supremacy and very much rooted in a politic of civility. As artists, I think we have to try to challenge while at the same time being receptive and sensitive to what people are expressing. But we're not I don't think we should just be hired guns and produce what the community wants, but I do think that we have to engage community in conversation. So for me, the conversation right now I'm having with folks around their loved ones who were killed is like, do we want to just stop them in this? Do we want to show them in this period of time where they're frozen, right? They're frozen in this period of time. However you capture them visually, you're stopping them at this point. Or do we want to try to expand and imagine giving what they've done in their lives, what they might have produced had they lived? Do we want to look at what they've offered to our movement, our community, even in their death, right? So how do we keep this idea of this person's contribution, the fact that they lived, still there, while at the same time, you know, raising questions about what, you know, about the fact that they're not here. You know what I mean? So I think when you just get, I think that that's an important kind of conversation you have with community because of the ideas of how we're represented in the larger population, in the larger, you know, society, because of how folks are very uncomfortable with being misunderstood or misrepresented or unseen, we become very, I think, limited in how we, like I said, in this politics of visibility and representation. And it's something that I think we have to have conversations with community around. You know, who made these decisions where are you getting these ideas of what we should look like, for example?
Thank you.
Melanie, could I prompt to see if you have anything to add to that? I'm realizing that was a great question. I realized as you were asking, I'm like, oh, each of these artists on this call have a strong practice that is not isolated, right? So I think that's something to raise up, and Melanie, you explicitly said that in your intro. Can you talk a bit about working with communities and leading visual choices, political choices, or shaping those?
Sure. I mean, I think it is part of the practice that we have, the sense of like this being a partnership and a collaboration, and like people come to the table with like a lot of different ideas and really trying to figure out, you know, like how we end up, because we do a lot of, you know, graphic work. Like, what do we end up representing? That's part of it. It's part of, like, that is radical imagination in process. And along the way, we will confront and we will inevitably have, you know, people generating ideas that reproduce things. And I think that's the place where we can really have critical conversations, you know, through a more, I mean, I think, through a pedagogy of like just asking questions, because I think people know if you can have that critical inquiry. Like I think maybe I can speak in more concretely. Like I'm working with an organization that works with youth, and I did a process where I went to their class, and we're really kind of like shaping this graphic. And I think as someone who's facilitating the process, it's important to be able to, like, dig deeper. Like, well, why would you want that
represented and what, you know, what is the alternative that we're seeking? Like, okay, this is the problem. And what are the possible futures? Like, what's the alternative? Like, what do we show? Because I think people tend to default to just showing how systems of oppression are represented, right? Like, I think the stuff we were talking about earlier, I think that to me is why it's really important, and it isn't always kind of recognized that the process that we go through to do this is sometimes way more important than the artifact of the thing. Like, I think people mm-hmm. recognize that we're producing a lot of images as a project, but what's not always evident is that process, those conversations, mm-hmm. Even the debate, like in that classroom, the debate between the young people, the young students, the young men about, well, what about this? And, you know, like that kind of sense of them having that voice to be able to shape it, but also to like challenge each other around pushing further their imagination. I think that in and of itself, like even if we never produce the graphic, that conversation itself is what's really, really valuable because it gets us past the place of just like resorting to, you know, the mechanisms for how we are punished all the time. And that was actually the conversation with these young people was around punishment. And it was really incredible. And it was something I think we, as, you know, if it was just like the artist doing it on their own, we wouldn't have gotten there. You know, and I think it has to do with the fact that everyone has, like, this multitude of experiences, and they're probably experiencing things that I might not have or may never experience. And so, like, that wisdom and knowledge comes into the conversation. And together, though, like, you know, as we're, like, pushing each other in the conversation, we come to a better place because it's a lot more nuanced. It's a lot it's a lot more rigorous because it's been this conversation that's happened. So and it's complex because, you know, the configuration of people that you have in a conversation changes at any given time. You know, and we work with a lot of different organizations. And one of the things that I see that's also really interesting is the partnerships that we have that are consistently, like, we keep working with the same groups, and that I think has, you know, much deeper impacts because of the consistent and long-term engagement.
I remember working with a group of young women at Bushwick when I was living in New York, and we were doing a community piece. And I think there's this tension around, we're doing a community installation, and there was this tension, around reality, our reality, expressing and showing our reality, mm-hmm. and aspiration, right? And so the artist wanted to portray some of their portraits with wearing designer jeans. And so this was like around the time when labels were a big deal, right? So all their characters or their portraits in this installation had on like design labels on them, right? And so I'm asking the question, why do you think that this is important, and who are you actually benefiting in showing this, like placing this label on your character's clothes? And we got into a really good conversation because they wanted their work to appear to be relevant, and they wanted their work to be timely. And so these kind of images of capitalism were were one way that they saw that would happen, you know. And so there was this heated debate about whether or not to put like labels on jeans of these representational portraits that they were doing. So, yeah, I think the conversation is way more important than what actually we produce.
If I could just add one quick thing to pick up on things that both Kai and Melanie have said. I think that, you know, one of the things that we have in the art world and in art schools that we do in art schools all the time, I teach in an art school, is critique. You know, we sit around, we talk about work, and we try to get people to not only get feedback on their work, and not simple feedback in terms of just I like it, I don't like it, but actually thinking in the space of critique, what is this doing? What is this about? What are the histories that are hidden in this work? What and so forth, like much deeper questions that help the artists, students, to think more critically and consciously about what they're doing, what the effects of their work are. And I think one of the things that winds up happening in a lot of, I think, more kind of top-down models of community-based art is a mistrust of the community to be capable of participating in that level of critique. And that is a kind of disenfranchising of people's own knowledge, their wisdom, their life experience, all the things that, you know, both Kai and Melanie have been talking about so eloquently, that it's a disenfranchisement of that in the same way that, you know, a part of the PIC has to do with disenfranchisement on much larger political levels. And I think that this point of involving people in the process where that's the moment of learning and that might be the primary site of the value of that work rather than what somebody in a gallery or driving by a mural sees, you know, I think it's so important. And I think, and I also think that that's something that's really hard in organizing too, is trusting the people you're working with, not just trying to get them to show up as bodies, but actually, you know, real organizing, you know. And I think to me, that's a very interesting kind of thing right there, that slippage between how we trust an audience or a community to participate in shaping what a work would be, or shaping the terms of their community, or knowing the solutions that they need as a community. I think that the slipperiness between that in an art context and an organizing context to me is really interesting and productive to think about.
Thanks, everybody. So we're a little bit past 10 a.m., and I feel like this could be a two-hour donor call. Please do, if you have questions that didn't get answered, send them along to us, and we'll think about how we could continue to create interesting, engaging forums like this. And this call was recorded, so you'll be able to play back your favorite moments and those key lines online later. We'll send out a link. I'm wondering if, in closing, each of our artists could share one thing that's exciting them right now about art as an opportunity for organizing, and using Ashley's language, trusting people to be part of shaping what the work will be. Is there something that you could leave us with, that's something to check out, look up, show up to, in order to be carrying on PIC abolition? Gonna go alphabetically backwards. So Melanie, closing out, is there one thing that's exciting you as a moment for people to engage in art making and organizing?
Yeah, so I'm in process of working to organize these things that we call print parties. And we've done them up here in Northern California, and the idea is to bring people together, and we screen print, and it's like the simple way to look at it is people learn how to pull a screen print, but really it's like kind of a way to just bring people together. And so we're working on doing one in LA with folks at Youth Justice Coalition, but also working with Self-Help Graphic. So I'm really excited about the idea of like bridging maybe groups together and having more conversations in that space, because they've been really fruitful up here. It's a lot of fun, you know. And usually we'll focus it around something that's happening, and it often engages other graphic artists, but also people that want to make graphics to do that. And again, it's like what I said before, things come out of it, but that's less important than the process itself. So we're in the process of doing, setting the date. It's going to be sometime in early June. So we'll be coming to SoCal to do that.
Great. And that's
awesome.
Being hosted and coordinated with CR Los Angeles. I'm part of the follow-up from our Abolition the Radical Imagination event,
yes.
Galvanizing people to take up the fight against the jail, proposed new jails in L.A. Awesome. So we'll send out information about that with Melanie's Southern California Print Party with those groups. Kai, something that's
cool.
Exciting you for engagement right now, or something you've experienced?
Nah, I'm pretty excited right now. I'm in the early stages of this next opera, and I'm looking for collaborators, mostly with people who are inside, or who work with people inside. By inside, I mean in prison. So I'm looking for prisoners to be the voices for this next piece, this next opera. And like I said, it's a kind of an adaptation of Women on the Edge of Time, the sci-fi novel, if people are familiar with that, and Luigi Dalla Piccola's opera, The Prisoner. And I'm looking for, it's set in 1974, following the August Rebellion at Bedford Hills. So I'm looking for prisoners, voices to voice the opera, and asking organizations who are working with prisoners to get the word out. I'm not trying to actually stage the opera till about 2018, 2019, most likely. So I'm in the early, early stages trying to get money, trying to get the personnel and collaborators, and also doing a lot of research on the ways that. And Ashley, I would love to talk to you more about this too in terms of the carceral landscape, but looking at the ways in which Black bodies are confined and also resist from the Middle Passage to 1974 as a possible stop point. But, you know, if people have information, if they have contact, please get in touch with me. Go online. There's a Gallery of the Streets. org. You know, there's a unbibliography on that site that people can also check out for some interesting, I think, resources. So, you know, just stay in touch, please, and I want to be more in touch with other folks.
Well, I'm really excited to be what am I really excited about? I'm really excited about the end of our semester. I'm really excited about that, because then I can really have more time to, I can really have more time to start just doing this work over my summer break. But maybe I'm excited about all the things we talked about. I think that it's always a weird thing to say. It's always weird when we're doing work around issues that are often so fucked up to say I'm excited about this, or, you know, I think we always find ourselves in weird moments of saying that or something. But I think the things that I'm, one of the things that I'm excited about really generally is the kind of interest and motivation that people seem to have to talk about these issues right now. And even though it's coming from a horrible place, at the same time, that horrible place is not a new thing. And we're coming out of other times in which no one wants to talk about it. So I think like the kind of energy that people are describing around their project and bringing people together. I just, Melanie, I just wrapped up teaching a zine making workshop at Self-Help Graphics with a bunch of young people, many of whom are from the area of Boyle Heights surrounding that Self-Help Graphics is in. And man, these kids were amazing. I mean, they're all just making their own zines about gentrification and violence against women and articulating articulating their own queer identities in the most self-possessed ways. That it's so beautiful to see the kind of consciousness that young people especially seem to have right now. That's really exciting me. And one other thing that excites me, and for those, since we didn't get to the question around museums and galleries versus the streets, there's a great new book that I've just started digging into called Mounting Frustration, it's called Mounting Frustration, The Art of Museum and the Art Museum in the Age of Black Power. And it's, so it's kind of like talking about many of the kind of protests and movements and discussions confronting the museum itself as a site of the realization of racism. It's a really interesting book, and it's like a really important engagement with that, I think, that question that we often perceive as a kind of either or. Either you work in the institutions or you work in the streets. And while either one of those is, of course, can be a legit path on its own, I think that seeing people try to trouble those boundaries and press against the way in which that boundary is also a boundary because of multiple forms and years and years of segregation, which is part of what this book argues. I'm excited about that book, Mounting Frustration, Susan Kahan. I don't know her, but...
Beautiful. Thanks, Ashley, Melanie, and Kaigi for leaving us with such great homework and next steps. So Mounting Frustration, check out DignidadRebelde.com, the Unbibliography on the Gallery of the Streets website. We'll be posting this audio along with some of these resources and others mentioned on the CR website very soon, so keep posted and check back there. And again, thank you everyone so much for listening, for supporting CR, for speaking and digging into this topic today. And these donor calls are for our movement and for movement building, and to show appreciation for you all helping us keeping CR afloat, bringing these ideas into action through campaigns, projects, political education, and movement building. So I hope everyone has a wonderful Friday. Onward, take care, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you.